not delving into the human room aspects of it, which are too obvious. We prefer to cultivate an attitude of gratitude for the blessings bestowed upon us, for this most precious planet we all share, life support system. And the opportunity through humility, gratitude, and prayer to come into contact in deeper touch with the creation and the creator and our own creativity to a world of change to the crisis facing the world as the ecology breaks down. In the past, man had the ability for homicide, and fratricide, and genocide, but never before the Industrial Revolution has man been able to threaten the world with such concepts as geocide. Homicide. And the threat is so overwhelming that the response is usually to numb oneself with whatever particular object of indulgence dulls the pain and the awareness of a crisis which we've all contributed to, willingly or not. We all share the same planet. We all share the same air and water and food and soils. The earth is our collective mother. She's also the collective psyche of all her children, which means that we have an interconnectedness on a deep level on which we share and we feel in the pain of starving children, in lands that were plundered to feed the excesses in other countries. On some level we feel the anguish of orphaned animals whose parents were victims of roadkill. And we're part of the system. And it's become an addiction, a collective addiction, just as an individual can become when he confuses his legitimate needs with his illegitimate desires and is led to believe that his desires are his needs. That then the anatomy of an addiction is in place, which proceeds into a state of denial, and you become dependent on your next fix in order to survive. You're not willing to admit it, that's denial. And the willingness and determination to change the anatomy of an addiction does not usually transpire until the addict is faced with a life-threatening circumstance because of his addiction. The planet, collectively, with all her subjects, is in a stage of collective addiction called consumerism. It has reached the state that if something still there is the denial, which is part of addiction. And rationalization. It's the same technology that creates the crisis can solve it. But as we said before, the pollution in the environment, which is contaminated, our soils, our food, our water, our air, the deforestation, which is choking the very lungs of the planet as the rainforests are being cut down to raise cows for slaughter. These problems cannot be resolved by the same mechanism created. So we approach the situation with gratitude, that the earth has reached a stage where only divine intervention can not only save, but redeem the collective consciousness of this planet. But it requires a change in consciousness, which will affect a change in our thought patterns, which will affect a change in our actions, which will affect a change in our environment, our ecology, and the future of this planet. I used to use a word to describe the condition, the polluted state of mind which afflicts most of the world today. Affluenza. And then I wondered, by any chance, could this be a real word? So I looked it up in the dictionary and found that it's not only a real word accepted by Webster, but Webster's dictionary analyzed the illness, the disease, very astutely, and also gave the solution. Would you like to hear? This is according to Webster's New Millennium Dictionary. Copyright from 2003 to 2008. Affluenza. It gives both the definition and the example. The definition is extreme materialism, which is the impetus for accumulating wealth and for overconsumption of goods. Mr. Gross. Definition is subtle, is the feelings of guilt and isolation from the dysfunctional pursuit of wealth and consumer goods. Example. Affluenza is the social disease caused by consumerism, commercialism, and rampant materialism. And its only antidote is simple. So the dictionary defines ecology as the relationship between the organism and its environment. Ethics means a system of morality. Standards of conduct. So ecoethics is the protocol for relationships in the context of the organisms with each other and with their collective shared environment. So different, and then there's two basic approaches to ecology. One is the objective, from the perspective of the detached observer who analyzes the phenomenon and gives his interpretation according to his credentials. The other is the subjective approach, as a living participant, environment we all share. So whatever approach you take to either ecology or ethics or morality or anything will remain speculative and potentially conflicting if there's not one universal and eternal point of reference. And therefore we have scripture. So the perspective that will be taken is that of dharma, which is a Sanskrit word, which means the intrinsic or inherent nature of something and its function in relation to the universal law and order. And in Vedic theology, everything is personal. And the personal form of dharma is the bull. Dharma is oftentimes generically translated as religion. But religion means faith. And faith can change. A Hindu can become a Christian. Muslim can become, or Hindu, or Muslim can become whatever. The dharma, the inherent nature of the soul, is to serve. And sanatana means eternal. The eternal nature, constitutional function of the soul is to serve. Everyone is servant of family, society, friends, culture. Ultimately, everyone is servant of God, whether willingly in devotion or unwillingly through the impulses of the laws of material nature. Sanatana Dharma is most explicitly explained in the Vedas. The most ancient, authoritative, and scientific scriptures. Veda is a universal world word. It simply means knowledge. And Vedanta means the conclusion of all knowledge, which is devotion. So, in the Vedic scriptures, the nature, the function, the form, and the role of this planet is described in a personal way. This planet we call Earth is a person. And all traditional cultures do that. She's a person, she's mother to all of us, who provides all our needs in a loving way, and she's a goddess. But the Vedas explain very scientifically her relationship to us, her children, and to the Lord. And in the Vedic scriptures, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, it's explained. It was formerly, in ancient times, an ecological crisis due to plundering of the earth's wealth in the form of gold, which so much affected her stability and orbit that she fell down into the bottom of the universe, a very dark and dirty place. And the one Supreme Lord, who assumes unlimited forms for the sake of his various pastimes and purposes, revealed himself in the wonderful and yet beautiful form of a boar. Suitable form for seeking out something in a dark and dirty place. And then he lifted her, placed her back in orbit. So by his touch, she was impregnated and gave birth to a son, named Boma, which means son of Bhumi, which is the name of the planet. This planet being especially dear to the Lord has something very significant to teach us all. In the Bhagavad Gita, it's explained that sacrifice to Vishnu, and this is not an Indian god, the deity. Vishnu means the all-pervading god. It's not a sectarian term. Sacrifice to Vishnu must be performed, otherwise whatever you do will bind you to karma, the laws of material nature, and the endless cycle of action and reaction called samsara, which is ever-turning. Because it has a bound to the reactions of our past actions, which creates further reactions and actions, which is accompanied by the sufferings of birth, death, disease, and old age. But by sacrifice to Vishnu, what does sacrifice mean? It means you give up willingly, hopefully, something of value to yourself for the sake of something you consider to be more precious, specifically the pleasure of another, meaning for the sake of relationship. You're willing to give up something that's dear to your selfish attachments. So what pleases Vishnu? He explains in Bhagavad Gita that one offers him something so meager as water, a leaf, a flower, or fruit. With love and devotion, he'll be pleased because that's cultivating a relationship with God. And Bhumi, Mother Earth, provides all these necessities to encourage and facilitate all her children to sacrifice for the pleasure of God, for the sake of restoring, reviving our original and eternal relationship with Him in love and devotion. There is a wonderful discussion in the Mahabharata when Bhishmadeva, one of the 12 greatest authorities in spiritual matters, was requested, what is the quality that makes one most dear to others? And Bhishmadeva responded, kindness, nonviolence. And he gave an illustration. There was an ascetic who would remain outdoors, who can go inside for shelter in bad weather, and he never cut his hair, so it grew very long and matted. And while he was standing in meditation, performing austerities, he stood so still that two birds thought he was a post in the ground, and they made a nest in his hair. So a saintly person is dear to all living entities. He is a well-wisher to everyone and will not do anything to intentionally harm or disturb anyone. So, after the birds made their nest and laid their eggs and the eggs hatched, he didn't move. When the birds grew up and were able to fly, he stood perfectly still. As they flew away, he came back, and every day they flew a little further, came back a little bit later. Finally, when they never came back to the nest, and the big birds vacated, then he took the nest out of his hair and mounted his life. But he became proud of his ability to show kindness and compassion and nonviolence to others. And pride is the root of all selfishness, all sinfulness. And a voice from the sky resounded and told him, "Suddenly, you are not equal in merit to that simple merchant in Varanasi named Tuladhara." When he heard that, he became enraged. And he went right to Varanasi to seek out that merchant. And as he was searching, one shopkeeper came into the street and said, "Suddenly, I've been waiting to meet you. I'm Tuladhara, you're seeking." He said, "How could a simple merchant who has never performed the kind of austerities or disciplines I have be so conscious?" Then they began to discuss spiritual matters. And in that discussion, the merits of kindness, compassion, and non-violence were considered. And Tuladhara said, "Generally, the best profession for man is the noble profession of agriculture. Before agribusiness was agriculture, the perfect setting for developing loving relationships, because in an agricultural context, you see that you are interdependent on others. When it's time for planting the crop or harvesting, everyone has to come together to participate. Otherwise, they perish. Agriculture nurtures cooperation, whereas technology fuels competition. So agriculture is the perfect setting. With that awareness, we're all interdependent. What is the function of envy or competition? It's destructive for the relationship between the individual and the whole. And selfishness is that, and greed is that perversion that the whole should be serving the part, which means the universe should go backwards rather than the healthy, prospering mentality that the individual flourishes and serves in the whole. Because the whole is God, of whom we're all a part. And He is the root of everything, material and spiritual. And serving the root, meaning living, giving your love to God, being the root, He has ample love that He can impart in your heart, love and compassion towards all living entities. And Sambandha, the first of the cardinal truths of Vaishnava theology, means relationship, proper relationship with the environment, which precedes bhakti, devotion, which culminates in love of God. So in their discussion, when Tuladhara was explaining how agriculture is the best profession of man, he said that there's a deficiency in that also, in that there is violence, unknowingly. When you plow a field, you're disturbing many living entities. So he said, even higher than agriculture, it's just the practice of perfect kindness and nonviolence. And gentlemen, he said, "But how would man live without agriculture?" And Tuladhara replied, "If mankind achieved such a state of kindness towards other souls, the earth would be so pleased that she would provide ample bounty for everyone without even being cultivated." Back to the verse, sacrifice to Vishnu must be performed. And the earth, goddess, our divine mother, is teaching us at every step to and facilitating that we sacrifice for what's most precious, a relationship with God, which is the foundation and the substance of loving relationships with anyone else, including the planet, the environment, family, society, friendship. So, all traditional ancient cultures had various names for the Earth Goddess, which all kind of coalesced in Mother Mary, who gave birth to Jesus, who gave such a different perspective of the nature of God to the Western world. The Old Testament God was seen as such a frightful being. The ancient Hebrews knew there's no difference between the Lord and His holy name, but His holy name was handled with such secrecy, fearing His presence, which was actually quite fierce. So Mother Mary became the revived form of all previous earth goddesses, giving birth to Jesus, intercessor between God and man, between heaven and earth. This is the role of this planet, intercessor between ourselves and our Lord, encouraging, facilitating, reviving our loving relationship with Him at every step. The Vedic scriptures go on to describe, and this is not some sectarian appeal, that Vishnu, the all-pervading God, the one Supreme Personality of Godhead, has unlimited forms for various purposes and functions, which all have different names. The origin of all forms of Godhead is Krishna. This is not a sectarian name, it's a sectarian deity. Krishna means all attractive. And Krishna spoke Bhagavad Gita, which is accepted in India as the most important scripture in revelation of absolute truth. As Krishna spoke to Arjuna, who was reluctant to fight in the battle of Kurukshetra, but being enlightened by Krishna's words, understood the temporality of the body, the eternal nature of the soul, and that by doing one's dharma and pleasing the Lord, you benefit everyone. In that discourse, Krishna explained to Arjuna the four classes of men: Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, meaning the political or the priestly class. Kshatriyas are administrators and warriors, Vaishyas, agriculturists, businessmen, Shudras, laborers. For the Vaishyas, their occupational duty by which they please the Lord is protecting cows. And the Brahmanas teach spiritual knowledge and the chanting of Vedic hymns, which purifies the environment. When the Mughals invaded India and ruled for 800 years, they were not able to change the faith of the people. When the British drove out the Mughals and tried to subjugate India, the Indian people had no objection to the British coming in and managing their land. Indians are not known as the best managers, so they were happy to have the British come in and manage things for them. But the British observed that they could not actually subjugate the people. They had no protest to the British coming in and managing the country. And the British realized that these people in India are so internally strong, they cannot be exploited. And the reason they're so internally spiritually strong is because of their faith in Brahminical culture and cow protection. Now this is not just simply some sentiment from a bygone age. It's very scientific. Brahminical culture means accepting the teachings of the Brahmana, means one who knows the difference between matter and spirit, how to apply matter to attain the spirit. Now there's two different schools of, you know, spiritual thought. One is, hey, this mature world is temporary and illusory, so why should we be concerned with ecology? We should simply attain liberation and focus on that. The other school of thought is that we're custodians of this world. If she's not being properly protected and maintained, we should strive to fulfill that purpose. So is this material world an illusion? No. It is illusive. What's the potential illusion? That we can enjoy this world. If this world was designed for us to enjoy, then the Creator must have been very faulty. And if it was designed for us to suffer, just for punishment, he must be somewhat cruel. Neither image suits the Lord, who created this world to teach us. And this planet is a divine teacher, assisting us, facilitating us in understanding how to correct our consciousness and our thoughts and our actions for the sake of loving relationships. So proper relationship with the environment makes everything prosper, not in terms of the false wealth that people are so much in pursuit of today, but prosperity means everything prospers. Wisdom, relationships, health, and progress towards the goal of life all prosper when we're in proper relationship with the environment. So why is the cow considered sacred in India? Because she gives the most essential ingredients required for sacrifice. As our human mother nurtures a child for however long before he's weaned, cow mother is the eternal emblem of motherhood, because she's always providing milk, which is the most important of all food substances, because it is the only food which develops the finer tissues of the brain which are necessary to understand the nature of God and our relationship with Him. And from that milk come such substances as butter and ghee, which makes such delicious offerings to prepare for the Lord's satisfaction and honor His remnants as sacred foodstuffs which purifies the consciousness, heart, and the mind. And the bull, or ox, before the invention of the tractor, tilled the land. When I was a child, our neighbors were farming with horses. And the tractor was just beginning to displace animal power. And with the tractor came overproduction. And then the government started paying the farmers not to grow crops. They pay them more to not grow crops than they would have received from their crops. So the land fell fallow. And gradually food began coming from California and other countries. What is that to the environment. The local economy is usurped by multinational corporations. You do not honor the relationship between needs and what the source is providing. Over-exploitation follows. Third world countries only exist because people in the first world countries thought that our stuff somehow ended up over there, and in the name of our vital interests, we'll get our back. And the earth provides sufficient resources for everyone, regardless of what the population might be. It's not a matter of what the number of the population is, it's what the population is doing. Because the earth is happy to provide for everyone. If they're utilizing her gifts properly, if that shows withholding. So, in former times, when the fields were being tilled by animal power, everything that came from the earth went back to the earth. The animals are fueled by hay and grain. And agriculture is considered more important than the milk from the cow, is the manure. Because that puts back and replenishes and expands everything that was taken from the earth. When the cow, emblem of motherhood, and the ox, emblem of fatherhood, are mistreated and displaced, then what goes back into the soil to replace the nutrients taken out? It may be blood meal and bone meal, which means even your vegetables and fruits are not really organic. Or maybe chemical fertilizers, chemical nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. The green revolution that made production multiply as it did with the introduction of the tractor. But the problem is, it's not nurturing the synchronicity of God's arrangement. Where the cow and the bull, who are taking so much from the earth, are putting back more. The microorganisms in their manure is like the digestive fire in the stomach, which breaks down and processes and puts nutrients in the food, without which, you see it today, obesity. People are eating more and more and more because they're starving for nutrition. They're getting the calories. They're starving for nutrition. Organic food, rich in nutrition, which the body can assimilate. But what are the chemical fertilizers? The nitrogen, synthetic nitrogen, is produced from petroleum. It's a toxic substance. It kills the microorganisms in the earth. It kills the soil. And requires more and more chemicals to produce the same yield as the soil is dying. This means we are dependent, we are addicted to oil. It's a speed of the tractor, which runs on petroleum, is lubricated by petroleum, is built out of steel and iron, plundering enterprises, polluting the environment, forests cut down to grow rubber trees for the tires, it's a syndrome. This technology and industrialization has created this syndrome in which everything is contributing to destruction and devastation. Where the Lord's arrangement is a synergy. You hear that word in terms of like herbal formulas. Say like, you know, herbal sedatives. Valeria has a calming effect. Combine it with hops, passiflora, skullcap, you end up with a synergy. Which means that the combination of these different herbs produces a result. result greater than the combined ingredients of all the different herbs. Or I say it in terms of animal power. So you have one horse, it's one horsepower. Have another horse, it's another horsepower. Put them together, and you may get three horsepower, although I've heard that they've actually conducted experiments that it's more than that. Where'd the other power come from? Well, you can say it's from the team spirit, but what is that? What is that? It comes from God, who likes, who's pleased when everyone is working together. Why is it that men like to go off to war? They like to, some of them. Or if they can't go off to war, they join the fire department. Or they play football. They just all go crashing into each other. And women look at it and go, what are you doing? If you tell a woman to see that number 13, he just got divorced and should take interest in the game. Otherwise, she'll go, what are you doing? What pleasure they get crashing into each other. But we need to feel like we're part of something greater than ourselves. And we are. It doesn't need to be artificially created by watching these games. So, anyway, back to the British. They saw that in 200 years they couldn't, 800 years the Mughals couldn't do it with all their force and group power. In 200 years, how did they try? These people have so much faith in the blessedness of the cow, in the sanctity of rabbinical culture, meaning spiritual instruction, that they cannot be subjugated, they cannot be exploited, until unless that faith is undermined. Or it's in America too. Now it used to be, there was prayer at the school, and it's been stopped. And the scientific theories all came in the West from men of the church. In the East, it came from sages. Like everything good in the hands of the wrong people is given a different angle. So, little children who go to school, the mind is like a blank slate, wants to learn so much about everything. And you hear these scientific theories. According to the principles of the educational institution, the teachers are not allowed to say there is God or there is not God. They just present. And it's not the teachers, they're just trying to do good. But these scientific theories, not true science, but pseudoscience, we're back to the British. In their attempts to subjugate and exploit India, they made a team of Indologists, including Max Müller, who translated the Vedic scriptures in English, saying that he wanted the Christians and Hindus to understand each other better. Problem is, translation of sacred text is more than giving proper word-for-word translation. Transliteration. You have to understand the spirit of the text. So Max Müller translated the Vedic scriptures into English, but it was tainted with his own consciousness to make Indian culture, which had been perfectly sustainable since time immemorial, appear to be backward, absurd, and highly inferior to British culture. He couldn't come out and say it because the people would not accept. But subtly, inferred through his translations, as well as the scientific theories, that made the Vedic scriptures seem absurd. The people gradually suddenly found their faith being undermined. And when people become weak in their faith, then they can be exploited. And after 200 years of British rule, when the Indian independence movement freed them, the first Prime Minister of India declared that our factories would be the temples. And in 50 years, technology destroyed the sustainable agriculture of India more than 100 years of mobile rule or 200 years of British rule could do. Seeing the glories of technology, putting devotion on a lower pedestal, and allowing the televisions to go into the remote villages and take the place of the deity on the altar, subjugated people of India made it vulnerable to exploitation as no one had ever done. So the Lord has created a sustainable arrangement for life to go on. But the Green Revolution has destroyed the soil. And that is still in future generations the prospects for life. So facing the scale of social and ecological crisis can leave one feeling powerless and numb. But by developing a sense of our relationship with the power greater than ourselves through gratitude, humility, and prayer. This relationship with the larger whole can facilitate His work acting through us and facilitate the recovery of the earth. Is there a time frame? No? So this whole creation, this whole cosmos, with all its planets, which orbit in such perfect balance, did not come out without a plan or an explanation as to its functioning and its purpose. Scriptures tell us that this earth is not only figuratively, but spiritually, our mother, our goddess, our teacher, who is instructing us at every step how to reawaken and cultivate our eternal but dormant relationship with the Creator. And ingratitude and humility, opening our hearts for that relationship, we will become channels of change. And every step you take, through first becoming aware and through awareness and purifying our consciousness so that we can act properly to achieve desired results, every step becomes another teacher as the solution unfolds. But it's not that just green energy like windmills and solar panels will solve the ecological crisis and pollution. It's the root problem of man's greed. nothing in all creation can satisfy the greed of man.
But where does that greed come from?
That selfishness, narcissism, chronic unrest, it's just a symptom of the soul's longing for a relationship with the Creator that is facilitated through His creation, which restores your own creativity and directs us to our role and function in doing His work in this world. And it's achieving the function and purpose of this world, which is ultimately to go back home, back to Godhead, to live eternally in the spiritual realm. Thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments? See, if man is not satisfied in his heart, and everything in creation is not satisfied. Satisfaction in the heart is born of relationship with God. You have to understand, develop, cultivate, and encourage that we become right with the Creator. And that satisfaction, the relationship, loving relationship with God, is not filled with consumer goods, which is just fueling the addiction of the spirit of the mind. The only antidote is, as Webster says, simple living, and how can we be satisfied with a simple lifestyle if we're progressing horizontally? Relationship with God. And that lives and encourage others to restore their original love relationship with God. And then you'll have the result. this is, we're in the winter season, the Kali Yuga. Kali is the presiding lord of this age, whose symptoms is quarrel and hypocrisy, and whose synonyms is iron and machines. So it's just part of the universal cycle that in the winter season, man's spiritual nature becomes very diminished. And materialism, fueled by technology and industry, is escalated. So it's just the natural stage of deterioration of the universe. It's that cycle we're in now, where man's spirituality becomes very decreased and materialism very aggravated. Within that culture, that Iron Age, and all religions and traditions have, you know, some sense of this, there's also the Golden Age, within the Iron Age, a millennium where devotion and spirituality abounds and materialism decreases. But outside of that 10,000 year period, we're in that winter cycle of the universe now, where things are deteriorating. And at a certain point, when it becomes so degraded, the Lord comes and restores the universal cycle back to the Golden Age. So it's a natural phase of the universe that leads to the state we're in now.
Avatar is Shukra, white.
teaches sacrifice. That's what his name is. I mean, he teaches meditation. Sacrifice for the acceptance of his meditation. So the Lord appears in the form named Shukla to teach meditation. In the Treta Yuga, he's formed as Vedish, Dakta, and he teaches sacrifice. Therefore, he's also named Yaja. In the Treta Yuga, his form is dark, so he's called Shyam, and he teaches temple worship of the deity. In the Iron Age, he comes in a golden form called Gauranga, or Lord Chaitanya, and he teaches the chanting of the holy name. Now the wonder is that in the chanting of the holy name, Prakasa is given the most degraded of all ages. That chanting of the holy name, because that is not different from the Lord himself, it includes all the processes of the previous ages. The meditation of the Satyuga, the sacrifice of the Chaitanya, the worship of the Dhariya is all contained and attained and surpassed in the proper chanting of the Holy Name.
What's a sacrifice in our chanting?
At times of initiation, and other occasions, we perform fire sacrifice, which is, it's a fire sacrifice, which is a cultural thing, largely, because it, see, in the Satyuga, in meditation, one would actually see in communion with the Lord in their heart. In the Treta Yuga, one would actually see and commune with the Lord in the sacrificial fire. In the Dhariya Yuga, one would actually commune and interact with the deity on the altar. So sacrifice here means fire sacrifice, in which in the Treta Yuga, oblations were made into the fire, and the qualified priests would see the demigods and the Supreme Lord appearing in that fire and taking their oblations. And giving their benediction. We attend fire sacrifices today. We don't see Brahma, Shiva, Indra, Vayu, and Vishnu himself appearing in the fire necessarily. But the same merits are achieved. Because we hold those fire sacrifices at initiations and marriages and certain other special occasions. And it's not, it's just a remnant. Cultural remnant of previous age has no significance because when it's accompanied with chanting the holy name, it revives and it's spiritual merit. That's called fire sacrifice. Anything else?
You're
going to see both. You're going to see a polarization. There will be an increase of God consciousness and God consciousness necessitates not that everyone live an agricultural life, but that a certain portion does. And there is a revival of that right now, which will increase. The degradation will also increase, and there's going to be a polarization. But according to the universal timetable given in the scriptures, the Vedic scriptures, we're at the beginning of the Golden Age now, which is simultaneously the best and worst of all times, because the desirable, devotional, uplifting, redemptive elements are going to become more and more prominent, but with them, there will be also an escalation of the opposition and degradation. So we're going to see both increasing with the relationship of polarization. And for a 10,000 year span, you know, 5,000 escalating and then 5,000 coming down again, there will be that dawning and increasing and then gradual diminishing of the 10,000 year period of the Golden Age within the Iron Age, in which God consciousness, agriculture, all desirable things will be increasing. But the initial stage, it'll be with great opposition. And then it'll take root and gradually diminish and then enter into the course of how the universe just deteriorates to the point where the Lord Himself has to come and restore everything in 327,000 years.
How do you curb your desires and practice living?
How do you?
Like, curb your desires and wants and live simply.
How do you curb your desires and wants and live simply? It's not so much a matter of curbing desires and wants as it is cultivating a higher taste. The higher taste for which every soul is eternally yearning is relationship with God, which is the root of loving relationships with all their souls. And you see, practically, that if one has that devotion to God and loving relationship with all beings, they'll be satisfied in the midst of unlimited deprivation. If one is bereft of that, he'll be dissatisfied and frustrated if he is whatever he is. You can have the whole universe at your disposal, and the more you get, the more you'll want. The fire it breathes burns more viciously, the more fuel you put on it. So it's not so much a matter of curbing desires as reviving that relationship which awards the higher taste. So you're just satisfied with your needs and you don't want anything more because you know it's toxic and detrimental to your relationship.
From inside and then try to affect outside. We're trying to work on the externals, manipulating the externals. So, you're both set up to attend our sessions on Thursdays. We meet at 7 states this year. I'd like to thank the team that made the dinner. Thank you very much. I already got a feedback from the person sitting next to me. It was really good. Thank you. Oh, sorry, we meet at 6:30. Sorry. Okay. Meet at 6:30. Oh yeah, we have another talk scheduled for March 19th, and that's going to be the psychology of yoga. So all of you are most welcome for that. I would also request each one of you to fill up a feedback. The feedback forms are available on the book table, or at the very least, you should leave your email ID, and we can put you on the listserv and let you know if any announcements or any emails that you know we organize. Thank you very much, and have a nice evening.